Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2016. Lecture 2, delivered on January 13, 2016. The title of this lecture is Terminology and Concepts.
Today, Terminology and Concepts. Let's start out with something. I'm going to ask you. Sir, what's this? Yes, you're good.
He's good.
Now, in finance, we actually distinguish between money, which is short-term, and something else that's really money, but it's long-term money. Do you know? Do you have any idea what we call longer-term money? Yeah, something you don't have for dinner tonight. No, it's called capital. Capital. When I'm talking about money that is going to endure, or you have to pay it back, or it's for projects or value assets. Capital assets refers to assets that have a long term, more than a year. If I'm referring to a market where you would get money for more than a year, or you would invest money for more than a year, I'm referring to a capital market. If I'm talking about a market where it's short, you need money for less than a year, or you want to lend money for less than a year, that's called a money market. Now, businesses need both of them. Interestingly enough, there are times when a very well-heeled corporation that's got a lot of capital money, it doesn't have short-term money. And there, as a matter of fact, there is actually a kind of quickie IOU that large credit-worthy companies issue so that they can get some 30-day money. That's called the commercial paper market. It's just like a quick IOU. I need Microsoft needs $20 million for 30 days. And this is a very thick market, and a lot of investors just, we got some money to blow for 30 days, so we'll just have it available to these to this money market called the commercial paper market. Now, those are large creditworthy corporations that participate in that market. Interestingly enough, that market's taken a couple of dings over the years. The companies that borrow money on short commercial on this commercial paper are large creditworthy reputable companies. But once in a while, one of those large reputable creditworthy companies is not so reputable and creditworthy. A great example was some years back when Enron was about to go under. Enron was participate all the time, grabbing commercial paper up and paying it off in 30 days. So in its last days, those crooks at the top of the company issued a pile of commercial paper. No one knew that it was going to be bad. And so the commercial paper market took a ding on that one. But anyway, okay. Now, as far as these capital and money markets are concerned, a lot of times, businesses, whether they're small or large, actually have a cycle of cash management needs. And I'll even tell you that in my own company, the company that I own, this is very much the case. You see, there are times in the year when you have no revenue or you have minimal revenue and you're strapped for cash. And then there are times of the year when you've got tons of money, you've got plenty of money. But the problem is, it's probably during those lean times is when you want to build your inventory so that you have it ready for when the customers hit the doors. So that's, in other words, you're talking about a lot of companies, it's the Christmas season. They're not selling much for most of the year. And so, but that's when they have to build their products and to get them ready for the market. And so what they do is they go to financial institutions and they set up essentially a line of credit. All right, during the year, we're going to project our needs on this budgeting process, and the book talks a little about it too. This budgeting process, we'll figure out what our needs are. We go to the bank. Okay, we are going to need a line of credit that we can draw down, and we've projected, here's our accounting statements and all that, we've projected that we're going to probably hit maybe $1.5 million. Kind of make it a pad, let's have about $1.75 million. Okay, so during the year, they can use this line of credit, tapping into it to buy the stuff for inventory, to pay the wages and salaries, to pay the light bills and all that kind of stuff. And then once the good season starts, well, then the money's coming in and they can pay off that line of credit, that working capital management deficit that they have with the bank or whatever financial institution it is. This is the reality. I mean, it's in some businesses, it's called floor planning. You're just essentially like a boat company. It will be floor planning and getting ready, putting boats on the floor, or furniture companies putting furniture out on the showroom floor. And then during the buying season, they sell the stuff and they pay it off. In my own company, I'm a professional landscape photographer. I sell my artwork during the spring, and the depth of it is the summer. And maybe some in Christmas, it's really not all that good. But I'll tell you, I'm building inventory. I have to get it all ready January, February, and early March. I don't have any money coming in during those times, so that's where the bank steps in and says, okay, we finance you during that time, and then you start paying us off at the art shows and the exhibitions, the gallery exhibitions, when they start. It's just a process. The problem, interestingly enough, the crash, that big crisis we had in 2008, and I'll tell you a whole lot about that, smoke your ears about some of the things that went on there, was that the banks suddenly stopped doing these floor plans, these working capital management. Oh, there's a credit crisis. We're not going to lend you any money. I mean, businesses, small and some large, just went tap city. They just died right there. Boom, you're gone. We don't have any money to build our inventory for the selling season. We're out of business. And these banks just sat back and said, well, it's a credit crisis. We can't just be lending money to anybody. Truth of the matter is that the banks had the money. They were having money shoveled into them in 2008 and 2009 by the Federal Reserve. Vast sums, a huge amount of it, in a secret program that was blown open in 2010. But for some reason, they saw all that money that they were getting from the Federal Reserve as not being worthy. The businesses in the country were not worthy of that money. They were investing it in overseas stuff and all these speculative stuff instead of keeping the lines of credit flowing. In other words, they were not doing what we hope financial institutions will do. And that takes me to a very important word. Sir, what's this stuff in here? Well, you don't know what it is. It's actually part coffee. Part coffee. Okay. Yeah. No. Okay, but not knowing what it is, listen to it. What is it?
Liquid.
Good. Excellent. It's liquid. The first terminology, or important word of terminology, is liquidity. Liquidity. The ease with which an asset can be converted to another asset, particularly cash. Liquidity is the ease with which one asset can be converted into another asset, particularly cash. Some assets are highly liquid. Some assets are terribly illiquid. So, in other words, madam, is this liquid or illiquid?
Liquid.
Huh?
Illiquid.
Can I turn this into a cheeseburger?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. I can turn this You could have one of these and you could actually turn it into a friend. A few more of them on Craigslist, I know, but no, really, dude, seriously, it's not bad. Yeah, it is, but anyway, it's a highly liquid. Cash is the most liquid. So when we talk about liquidity, on the liquidity scale, cash is the most liquid. Very close behind cash, almost exactly as liquid, are United States Treasury bills, T-bills. A T-bill is a short-term government borrowing. So you could use, now you can't buy a cheeseburger with a T-bill, but you can certainly, banks consider them to be tier one liquidity, just like cash money. Illiquid assets are things like, for example, you, woman, are illiquid. Do you know that, right?
I suppose so.
Why? Why would I say you're illiquid? That's right, not right away. See, we can turn you into cash over a long period of time. We develop and train you, educate you, and then you go out there in the workforce and you earn money. You generate revenue. We can convert you into cash, but it's a slow process. It's a lot of money over your life, but it doesn't happen. I can't do it instantly. So you're an illiquid asset. Your car, or that thing you call a car, is an illiquid asset. Because it's not terribly illiquid, but you see, you're going to pay a lot to get rid of it real fast. A house is an illiquid asset. So in other words, when we're talking about liquidity, liquidity has the upside. You can turn it into something very quickly. But liquidity also has a downside because longer-term investments tend to return more than short-term investments. Because there's more risk in a long-term investment, so you expect a higher return on it. So, in other words, when companies have cash, we have to look at them. Okay, you've got a lot of cash. Well, that's great because you can pay your bills, your light bill, right away. But at the same time, you would ask, all right, you've got so darn much cash, you could be investing that in long-term projects that would return more for your shareholders. So why aren't you doing that? So it's a balancing act. Too much cash, you're probably not using your cash, your money efficiently. Too little cash, and you might not be able to pay your bills today. There are plenty of examples of very wealthy families that have a lot of asset value, but it's all illiquid asset value. It's capital value, not money value. Okay. So keep that word liquidity in mind. Now let me take a few minutes here to talk about money. I want to talk about money. That green shirt is just screaming at me to talk to you. Seriously, man. Okay. What's money?
Value assigned to, it could be a lot of things.
Value. You're being really direct with me here. I know, kind of blindsiding you.
Yeah.
Okay. Are you money? Are you money? You sure are.
Well, okay. Value.
See, here's the problem, is that money is anything that is generally accepted in exchange for something else. Money is anything that is generally accepted in exchange for something else. Anything. So we could start out with something like this. You, sir, bake apple pies. They're the best damn pies I've ever had. Now, I go out and I kill a moose. Now, I take it around, and I do this for a lot of people to trade for other things. And I bring you a moose. And for one moose, I get five pies. I say, I have a moose. And you say, okay, five pies. I go to you, I have a moose. You bake cheesecakes. And I get a cheesecake. You got nothing. but you see, that moose is money. Moose money. This is a kind of money that's called barter money. Barter money. Now, the thing about barter money, now remember, barter money is would be anything that is accepted in exchange for something else. But barter money is interesting in the sense that it has full value as the asset itself. It has full value as the asset. The moose itself is edible. Well, most of it is. Have you ever had moose? It's not that good, but, you know, it's you could use the whole moose, everything, even the antlers. You could wear them as a hat. It'd look really boss at one of those ISU games. Okay, moose. Okay, now, there's another, the next kind of money in this liquidity or whatever you want to call it would be commodity money. Now, commodity money, sometimes people call it metal money. Metal money. Gold is a commodity money. It's generally accepted. Would you take gold for a cheeseburger if I wanted you to make me a cheeseburger and I gave you a gold coin? Sure you would. The problem with it's generally accepted. Silver, platinum, other metals through time, alloys. But it doesn't carry full intrinsic value. It has intrinsic value, but not full intrinsic value. We see that there have been times in history when metal monies have been hammered into things like spearheads, musket balls, arrowheads, and other things. So metal can be used, but it has not as much intrinsic value. Gold is a great example. Gold is actually, it's usable. It's surprisingly, it's pretty, but it's got some use outside of being gold. But there's still that has to be accepted part of it. There's still that belief in it. So it has some intrinsic value, but not complete. Now here's the last kind, fiat money or fiat money. I used to pronounce it fiat until I got these people correcting me. I'm pretty sure it is pronounced fiat, but whatever. Okay, fiat money. Well, let me show you. Let me show you fiat money. This is fiat money. Fiat money.
Can you read right there? Read that right there. You see that little print?
Yeah, this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private.
The sovereign has decreed that this is money. You cannot say no to it. This thing has virtually no intrinsic value whatsoever. The only value it has is value that is prescribed by law. I can't say no to this because the sovereign has said this is money. So the fiat money has no intrinsic value. Well, practically none, yeah. Years ago, well, I'll talk about that a little later, but anyway. So here are the three kinds of money that are out there. Now, there is actually a fourth kind that is emerging. And I'm an advisor to the Illinois State Students in Finance. And I brought in some of my cohorts from the outside world, cryptocurrency hashers. Do you know what cryptocurrencies are? Have you ever heard of Bitcoin? That's a crypto. The cryptocurrencies don't exist anywhere in physical space. They actually don't exist anywhere at all until a hash is found to break an encryption and get capture one of the coins. That's what hashers do all day and all night. They're just trying to find the correct hash. Hashed for a coin so that they can grab it out of the deep web, out of a transaction in the deep web. This is emerging. I'm not going to talk to you about it. I'm not preparing you for jobs in the 21st century, but I am going to take some of my students over to a hasher's den later this next month if any of you are interested in seeing what Bitcoin play is like, how it actually happens. It's really kind of cool world, but I do want to caution you, there is another one here, the cryptos, but I'm not going to spend time in here because it would take me a while for you to get your mind around what they are, actually. They're, anyway, that's money. Okay, now. Next thing I want to do is I'm going to talk again about markets. Markets can be broken up so many different ways. It's almost, it's like dizzying. And sometimes I get myself confused. As you can tell, I never use notes in class. I think that it's like, you remember Arnold Schwarzenegger? Arnold Schwarzenegger once long ago said, "Don't be a girly man. Don't use notes in class." Okay, I don't think he said that part, but so I get sometimes a little confused because there's so many ways you can divide up the concept of markets. You remember a minute ago, I talked about the difference between money markets and capital markets. Okay? That's one way you can split markets up. Then there's another way you can split them up. Financial markets versus product markets. Now, when I say products, I'm referring to this in a large sense. It could be a physical thing or it could be a service, commodity. But the financial markets are the ones that we focus on in finance. However, we do go into an aspect of the financial markets that is connected to the product markets. It's called commodities markets. There's a sort of that in there. But in the financial markets, essentially, I'm asking for it because there's a third one, but in the financial markets, you can break the financial markets up in two large pieces. One would be debt markets, and the other would be equity markets. The debt markets are the markets where of borrowing and lending. The equity markets are the markets of ownership. So when I say equity, an equity security, the classic equity security is common stock. It represents ownership in a corporation. When I talk about the debt markets, the classic one most people would think of is the bond market. There are other debt markets that are very active. Remember, I actually just told you about one, the commercial paper. That's a debt market. So there are debt markets. There are a variety. I'm going to go into those in a little more detail maybe today, maybe not today. But know this, interestingly enough. Well, let me try this on you. Let me try something. Sir, which is larger, the debt market or the equity market? In fact, it's 10 times the size of the equity market. Interesting enough, it's a much quieter market. One of the problems with the debt market, you hear about this stock went up today, that stock went down, this stock index, the Dow Jones Industrial Average went up. You hear all about the stock markets all the time. You don't hear about the debt markets because they aren't sexy. They're actually very quiet markets. They are less risky. That's why when we are talking about planning for people's future, we would be more likely to have a portfolio of a young professional like you be tilted toward more stocks in the portfolio. But someday you're going to get old and ugly and you're going to have a fat ass and you're going to sit around scratching. Then that's when you're going to be more likely we would move you towards the debt markets because they're less risky, okay? They're just less risky. And so they're quieter, and they're not as sexy and all that kind of stuff. The stocks don't go up, the bonds don't go up and down in price too much. But know this. There are a couple of reasons bond markets are safer than stock markets. But the big, big 800-pound gorilla reason is this. You've got the owners of a corporation. They have bought in for a piece of the ownership action. Those are the stockholders. The stockholders are the owners. They have bought in for a piece of the action. The bondholders have just lent that company money, and they expect it back. So the very first claim on cash flows goes to the bondholders, the debt holders. You have to pay them off first. And if there's anything left, it belongs to the stockholders. If you don't pay the stockholders, all they can do is bitch at you. And I can tell you many stories about this. You see, when a company earns its money, it pays its bills, it pays its debts in a timely manner. It doesn't have to pay everything off right away, you know, if there's some term loan. But it has to pay its debts in a timely manner. If anything at all is left over, the shareholders have that residual claim. So the equity holders have residual claim. The debt holders have the prior claim. Now, a company can do two things. If it actually has money after it's paid its debts, it can do two things. Remember, that money belongs to the shareholders. But the executive officers, the officers and directors have to decide, okay, we've got money left over, it belongs to shareholders. What are we going to do with it? There's two things that it can do with that money at the residue if it's there. It can actually pay a dividend, or it can reinvest in the company. Or it could do a combination of both. You see. So let's say a company has $1 million profit. Okay? It's paid its bills for the year. It's got $1 million left over. Now, if it has, let's say, 100,000 shareholders, it could give each of them a $10 dividend. Use up the money that way. Or it could take that $1 million and put it back into the company. Ideally, what that would do is the projects would enhance the value and the stock price would go up and the shareholders would benefit from that. So dividends give the shareholders their stuff, their claim right now. Reinvestment holds it off for the future. Young companies generally tend to not give dividends because they need to plow back, and that's a term, plow back, all of their money they can into operations to grow. Only later do they give dividends. I can tell you right now, I was a consultant. I helped small companies go public and be public. I did that for many years until I was driven out of the business. Statutes of limitations are all over, so I can talk about it now. But anyway, look. I mean, I went up there as the spokesman at shareholder meeting. It happened more than once. Off the ground, stockholders had bought penny stock in this corporation, and that first shareholder meeting, there they were, yelling, "Where's the dividend? Where's the dividend? You made a profit. Where's our dividend?" I had this one woman. She just yelled, and she was just having a fit at us. And, you know, you have to be diplomatic with people like that. You have to be nice to them. Yeah, I just said, "Look, bitch, you can either have your money now and we won't be here, we won't grow, or we can put this money that, yes, it is yours. There's no question about that. But we are the financial stewards of that money, and we have to determine if it is worth us to use that money back in the company." The truth of the matter is that giving dividends out is, in kind of a theoretical way, a stupid thing to do. Why would companies ever give dividends if they could just put that money back in and grow the company and then make the stock price go up? There have been theories over the years, and we do understand kind of what the idea of dividends is. It's more like a signal than anything else, that we can do this. It's like you got a filthy rich uncle. He just hands you a $100 bill just to show you that he can do that kind of stuff. I was at this very fancy corporation's annual Christmas party one year, and the CEO was right up there letting everyone know that it had been a great year. It was just a great year. And I swear, it was the first time I'd ever seen it happen. He gave this speech about how everyone in the company had contributed to this incredible year and how everyone was going to get bonuses and all this. And then that son of a bitch took a cigar out, and he lit it with $100 bill. Yeah, and he pulled out, oh yes, it was a very good year. And he tosses this burning $100 bill in the ashtray. I'm like, he did it. I thought, I had never seen that before. I never saw it again quite like that. But he did that because he could. He was just basically throwing money away to show that how well-heeled they were. And that's kind of what we think a lot about dividends, is that it's a way that a company shows that it's so flush with money at the bottom line that it has plenty to reinvest to grow the stock, and it has some left over to throw out to the shareholders as dividends. But know this. The debt holders have the prior claim. If you don't give the shareholders, if you've got no profit, you don't give them anything, all they can do is cry and whine at you. The debt holders, if you can't pay them or if you don't pay them, they will simply shut your corporation down. They will take you to court, and the court will turn your corporation off. That's what debt holders can and will do. They are so powerful. As I tell people, the debt holders will shoot your dog, sell your Bible on Craigslist, and make your mama wear furry costumes that please them. Mrs. Fox, I recommend starter kit. No. Anyway, never mind. You understand what I'm saying? The debt holders will shut you down if you don't give them something. If you don't pay them in a timely manner. And I'm talking about debt holders of all kinds. That's the supplier who sent you the stuff and you pay him later. That is the bank that you borrow the working capital management money from. That's the note holder that lent you money for 5 years. That is the bond holder that lent you money for 20 years. That's your workers who you didn't pay. They are your debt holders. They have prior claim over the stockholders. They all can take you down, and they will if they have any brains at all. You don't pay them, they switch you off. And then you scream to the court, protect us under Chapter 11. Please protect us. And the court might say, okay, you've got to give us a reorg plan so that these debt holders say yes to it. Because in the end, the debt holders will decide whether or not any reorg plan that is issued under a Chapter 11 receivership actually is worth worrying about, or if they're just going to liquidate your company. Now, debt comes in different flavors. Short-term debt is called a bill. That's anything less than a year. That hence T-bill. The government borrows money for up to a year. That's a T-bill. Then there are the notes. Those are from 1 to 7 years. I think I've seen 1 to 10, 1 to 7. It's not really too important. By the way, I'll bring it up. And then there are the bond markets. Bonds are more than 7 years. Now, here's part of this process where I begin to get you to think in a way that is not common thinking. When you borrow money, you are the issuer of a debt instrument. I, lending you money, am the buyer. I am purchasing that debt instrument at the price that will be what I lend you. You need to borrow $1,000. You issue me an IOU, a debt instrument. I purchase that debt instrument for $1,000 from you under terms of how you'll pay it back. You got it? Kind of an interesting thing there is that people think about it, Okay, you're going to get your first home, okay? You want to get a mortgage. You go to the bank. You are the issuer of a mortgage bond. Mortgage simply means there's an annex on it that attaches an asset. The basic instrument is a bond. You have issued a security. The bank buys the security. You're saying, no, wait, I didn't issue anything. I didn't have any paper. Yes, you did. Well, yeah, there was paper, but the bank had it. No, they just wrote it on your behalf. You were the issuer of the debt, and the bank is the buyer of the debt. You got that? So if you would decide you're going to buy a car on a six-year loan, okay, what type of debt instrument is it?
Notes.
Bingo. Are you the issuer or the buyer?
The issuer.
You are issuing a note. Who is the buyer?
The car dealership? Well,
the sucker bank that's going to lend you. I wouldn't lend you. No, anyway. You're going to get one of those nice little cars, like a Soul or a Mia. Don't they recall for ugly anymore? But anyway, never mind. Okay, so you got it. Yeah. That's how it works, is that the borrower is the issuer of the debt instrument. The lender is the buyer of the debt instrument. The price of the debt security is what the amount of the loan is. Now, there might be a little discrepancy with points and fees and all that, but it all works out that you're on the hook for a price, and there will be terms and conditions on that thing. If you get that concept down, it's kind of like most people don't think, a bill. Okay, I got a bill from the electric company. Well, actually, all the electric company did was print a bill that you had issued. By using the service over a period of, let's say, 1 month, what they had done is they had fronted you the money for that electricity. And now they are going to show you, well, this is the bill that you issued to us. We're printing a copy of it. So now you please satisfy that bill. That's what a bill actually is. Can you follow that? It's actually one of those things, like, it's a weird way to think about it, but that's how we have to think about it in finance. And in any, a lot of different places where you'll be dealing in your professional lives, beginning to think in terms of who is the issuer, who is the buyer. Like with stock, you see, a company can raise money by borrowing, or it can raise money by selling pieces of ownership, common stock or something like that. The thing of it is that if you borrow money, you're stuck in this, you have to pay them back or they'll shut you down. But with stock, you don't ever have to pay them a dime. I mean, they're just along for the ride. Why would any company ever issue debt? Well, one reason is pretty simple, right off the top. Debt is safer than equity. So the cost to a company of issuing debt is going to be lower. Why is it safer? Because debt holders have the first claim. Stock is risky as hell. So the investors in stock are going to expect higher returns compared to the investors in debt. There's another reason, too. You see, when you borrow money, there's an end to the relationship. 30 days, a year, 5 years, 30 years, whatever. You pay your payments, and eventually you pay it off, and then you're done. With stockholders, you are married forever to those SOBs. They are part of the company. So it's the difference between having one of those brief relationships you're so famous for, or getting married. Okay? Like anyone's going to marry. Oh, anyway. No, you see, you understand that the upside of debt, the downside is that they can kick your butt. You get in trouble financially, they're not going to give you any mercy. I had 1 year in my company. I mean, it was just that one of that year when there were just storms and rain and it was god-awful hot. The shows were just not paying, and I was really close to not being able to pay loan, pay my loan payments. And they were just going to shut me down, take everything away from me, and hang me out to dry, and that's it. Game over. If I had had partners or owners, well, they couldn't have done anything but whined and griped about how bad it was. We were in it together. But at the same time, if I have owners, then they have, I have to listen to them. I have to be friends with them. I have to let them participate with me, maybe. They're my, not just my buddies, they're my partners in marriage. So debt, as scary as it is, it's in, for a lot of companies, it's a lot better because it's cheaper, and it's also, it's a shorter-term relationship. Stock lasts forever. Because you see, the understand this, there are three types. Now, the book talks about this fourth type of company called a limited liability company. Just read the book. I have no use for those things. They're bullshit. But the basic kind of company that anyone can run, that almost all of you have actually run, is what's called a sole proprietorship. A sole proprietorship. It's a one-man show. It's just you. All at risk. You got no protection. You mow a lawn for money. You're a sole proprietor. Period. You're driving along with your lawnmower mowing that lawn. And for some rich person here in town, and you run over her poodle. Hey, guys! Give it a show dog trim. Okay, you know, she's going to take your lawnmower. She's going to take your truck. She's going to take that hovel you live in, take those glasses of yours and that butch jacket, leave you with nothing but a barrel. Because she can take everything of yours. You get all the revenue minus expenses. You are right there on the front line for any liability that you create. Whether it's a bill you owe. Well, that was for my company, man. Well, if the company's assets don't cover it, they'll just take everything of yours. Now, by the way, sole proprietorships, just a quick name, quick thing. Many, almost all of you have been sole proprietors. Almost all of you. Now, it's kind of hilarious. The book gives you a little bit of a statistic. Sole proprietorships constitute officially 70% about of all companies' business activity in the United States. They constitute less than 20% of all revenue. But know this, sole proprietorships are the backbone of the country. They always have been since the beginning of time, and they still will be. If you earn money doing productive work, you're a sole proprietor. Now, there are even official channels you can create a fictitious name. Every state, no, by the way, know this. Companies are state entities. Companies are not federal entities. The federal government sticks its big hairy toe in, but they're state entities. The deal is this, though. I mean, you can any state, and I'll give you a couple of examples of my own work. In my own work, any state will let you use a DBA, a doing business as. Some states call it a fictitious name. Other states call it an assumed name. Here in Illinois, the way it works is you can download this form, you fill it out, you take it. And you fill it out. It says, well, what's your real name? Where do you really live? Okay, what name do you want to call this business of yours? And you just pick a name. Pick a nice name. And then you take it back to the county clerk's office, to the county clerk, county recorder. County clerk. And they stamp and they say, all right, you now have to publish this in a business circular. And it has to be there for, I think it's 3 weeks. So there are all these places around. Every state has these cheapo business publications. You see them stacked outside of grocery stores and stuff like that. And I've used one every time. He said, all right, just get me a copy of the form, and they publish it. I pay him $35, I think it was, and they publish for 3 weeks. So-and-so has claimed this name, this fictitious name. And if there is no challenge to that publication, no one contacts that publisher. 3 weeks later, and again, I think it's 3 weeks later. 3 weeks later, he sends me a notice saying no challenge was given to this assumed name that you are claiming. I take that back down to the county clerk's office, and they issue me a really nice certificate. This is your name. So when you hear on my podcast at the beginning, Dark Wraith Publishing presents, that is a fictitious name I claimed. And it is mine forever. Okay? Now, other times, what I did with another company of mine, the one that is my standing S corporation, Emergent Light Studio, it began as just one of those fictitious names for its first few years of business. And then I took that over into the corporation structure, and now it's Emergent Light Studio, Inc. is the name of the corporation. But it started out as a fictitious name, too. And I've done that, Dark Sun Energy, the American Pacific Mining Company. They all started as DBAs, fictitious names. They're not really as strong. It's not like a copyright or a trademark or a service mark, but it does give you some protection. And it allows you, you can go to a bank and say, well, I'd like to open up an account under such and such name. And they look at you like, no, you have to use your name. And then you can show them this, and they'll say, oh, this is a DBA. And they'll let you do that. Or you can use your own account for the DBA. So it sounds better if you say, well, don't make this check out to me. Make it out to whatever your company is. Show Dog Trims R Us, something like that. Okay. The next kind of company is a partnership. A partnership is very similar to a sole proprietorship. The partners are jointly and severally all at risk. Jointly and severally. And it's more than one person. Understand this. It's jointly and severally all at risk, and it's more than one person. Jointly and severally all at risk. Here's the problem with that, of course, is that if you're in a partnership, I'm in a partnership with you, madam. If I screw up, you are jointly and severally responsible for my entire screw up. You understand that, okay? That's why if you're going to have a partner, you a damn well better believe in that partner, know that partner. That's why those of you who will go into accounting or law or architects or dentistry, many of those are organized along some type of partnership line. But they're going to work you like an animal for a couple of years. And only if you are up to par, and only if you are the best of the associates that they've brought in, are they going to bring you in fully as a junior partner. Otherwise, they'll just kick you out and say, no, you're not good enough. That's why it's like a hazing experience. It's terrible. Did any of you see that movie, Pursuit of Happiness? Yeah, that was a hazing. That was the hazing in the brokerage business. I mean, it's just brutal. It's just, beat the hell out of you and make you miserable, and then if you are the one, all the others, nope, the one who's the best, they'll bring him in as a junior partner. And the reason is simple. Once that person is a partner, that person is there forever. Know this about these kinds of partners. Know this about sole proprietorships and partnerships. They are nothing but the people. Now, by the way, a partnership actually is formal. You have to file a partnership agreement with the state. Sole proprietorship, you can just start on your own. You don't have to file, here's our partnership agreement. But here's my sole proprietorship agreement. With a partnership, you have to be formal with it. But these are mortal, just like their owners. They are their owners. They are their owners. So when a sole proprietor, in a sole proprietorship, when the sole proprietor dies, that's it. The sole proprietorship is dead. It's gone. You don't hand it off to your loved ones or anything like that. It's gone. Similarly, and this is something people don't know, in a partnership, if one of the partners dies, the partnership is over. That's it. That's the end of the partnership. Now, if you're a sophisticated type, you've created it so that essentially when someone dies, the partnership collapses into a new partnership without that person in it. But if you've just got a partnership and you don't have that kind of regeneration clause set up, one of the partner dies, it's over. Well, I'm going to give this to my husband. No, you're not. You can't give it. It's the partnership is done, dead, gone. Now, there's one in here after this one called the... Oh, there's one interesting twist on the partnership. It's called a limited liability partnership, and I did these quite a bit. Limited liability partnerships essentially are partnerships, but there are these general partners, and then you sell units to limited partners. Now, they call them limited partners because their liability is limited only to their investment. So I did different kinds of limited partnerships, and I've low-income housing for the elderly, oil and gas partnerships we would do. We would sell units, 50 grand a unit, to limited partners. Now, the thing was that a limited partner is not allowed to touch management operations. They put their money in and then they sit there and shut their pie holes and hope that things work out. Limited partnerships are, interestingly enough, I was using them for low-income housing for the elderly. Essentially, the way that they would work back in the day is that we were trying to, the federal government and state governments wanted to provide decent housing for old people, subsidized rent and all of that. But how to get it built, how to get nice, decent apartment complexes built. So the way the government had done it is they said, all right, any company that can raise money, what we used to call commit blood, now they call it commit skin. Any company that can commit blood, the government, federal and state government, will match that money with low interest and no interest loans. So what we would do is we would get the plans for a nice big apartment complex for old people, which would have subsidized rent by a program with the government. And we would then sell limited partnership units to wealthy investors, doctors, lawyers, dentists, architects, you name it. We would sell these units in the partnership. And then that would be our blood. Then we'd go to the government, state and federal government, and say, all right, we've got $10 million. Match it. We'd have a $20 million, and we'd build a decent apartment complex. And then it would be managed by some company and all that kind of stuff. And the old people would have a nice place to live in their old age instead of in some hole in the ground. And, of course, every year we would issue the limited partners. Well, you know, let's say you invested $50,000. Well, here's the thing is we lost $40,000 income. That's your part of our loss. And also the apartment complex is depreciating like hell, so you lost another $18,000 there. Shit, we're sorry. Year over year, we'd lose the money until we spun it out. They'd get a loss, an income loss, and then they would also get a depreciation loss. And all the time, these rich people were calling us back, when can we get another one of these going? Please let us in on this. Oh, God, we want so much to invest in another one of these. Why? Oh, simple, because $50,000 is what they put in. And then year after year, they got to write $40,000, $30,000, $80,000 against their taxable income in their profession. A doctor making $500,000 a year, his tax bracket is awesome, high. And so he gets to say, oh, I lost $40,000 in this project. Oh, and I also lost this, too. So they were shielding money year over year out the ass. And so they loved it. They just loved it. Well, that was one kind. Now, there were not all of these limited partnerships you lose money. Some places where you saw limited partnerships, some of the first places I saw them in my consulting, which went back years, was interestingly enough in the porn industry. I covered up my mic for that. Simply because you need $250,000. Camera, two cameras, and maybe a third backup. You need talent. You need five talents, and you probably need two decks of lights. You probably need three settings, 2 days, it's a couple of hotels. So it's not that I understand the but we get limited partners. Old geezers with tons of money, we'll sell you a limited partnership, $50,000. We put together $500,000 in those. We wouldn't let them near the set because limited partners, you can't let them near the sets. They'd be barking at us for that. And then once we had the movie in the can, take us 4 days to put the movie, not us, I was heard about it. I actually did. I was on the outside of this thing, but this is where I learned a lot about it, was seeing these things, operations go. Put them in the can, create VHS and beta tapes. Back in that time, it was VHS and beta. Some 15,000 stores that would pick up 2-3 copies of them. Then you'd gather up the rest and sell them into foreign markets. You had easily, on one movie, maybe $15 million. Distribute some to the limited partners, pay yourself a huge salary, and you are on your way to your next one, over and over again. Now, this was picked up some years later in the entertainment business. It started with these movie makers who got sick to death of the rich movie moguls running their scripts, running their cast, running their shows. And they started going out there and they started bringing the money together themselves through limited partnerships. Indie movies are many of the great ones, even mainstream movies. Interestingly enough, there were mainstream movies that were actually designed to look like indie movies. Any of you know what an indie movie that was designed to look like a mainstream movie that was designed to look like an indie movie? It's a horror movie some years back. Yeah, that was one of the great ones. Looks like an indie movie, straight up pro mainstream. Does anyone know an actor who started his own paying for his own films because he was so sick of Hollywood's movie rich people? Anyone ever watch Mission Impossible movies? Then it started to show up some years. It's actually shown up in the music industry too, entertainment. Some of the rappers they were being shut out. They had great music, they had talent, and they were being shut out. They were smart. They went to the lawyers who set up limited partnerships to fund their albums. And now they can write their own, make their own labels, cut their own albums, and they're on their way. Some of the greats of rap and hip-hop were among the first. And now some of these garage bands are figuring it out. They're coming up straight up through limited partnerships to fund their albums. And now you've got these GoFundMes, and you've got some GoFundMes for movies, you've got GoFundMes for other projects now. Basically, the financing world has finally matured to the point where the grip is still there of these powerful, wealthy people of Wall Street and of Hollywood, but the grip has been loosened because of limited partnerships. Now, The last one that I'll talk about, though, of companies is the corporation. Corporations are the pinnacle of business. In a corporation, the company is a legal entity. The shareholders are not the company. The company is recognized as a legal entity under the state laws of the state of incorporation. Where the company is, the state in which a company incorporates is called its state of domicile. It is domestic in that state. In all other states, that company is a foreign company. So my company, Emergent Light Studio Inc., is domestic in Illinois, and its nexus of business is in Illinois. But when I do a show in Missouri or Indiana or Iowa, I am a foreign corporation in those states doing business there for a while. Now, you incorporate not necessarily in the state where you're doing most of your business. The reason is that some states are much more favorable to corporations than others. Delaware is classic. It is so mature in terms of its business law, the judges that adjudicate business matters. It's just timeless. Other states are actually, I would never incorporate in some states, because they are just so hostile to business. Truth of the matter is that Illinois is not great, but at least I don't pay my tax, my sales tax on time, and they just yell at me. They're not violent and bullying, but I mean, there are some states I just wouldn't touch. Florida, South Dakota, Utah used to be a wild west. Anything went, and then they turned all sphincter-oriented, and Nevada the same way. I mean, there are some states you just will not incorporate in just because they are so, their law is so capricious, their administrators and regulators are such jackasses, and their laws are hostile. And so you don't necessarily incorporate in the state in which you're going to do all your business or most of your business. Quite honestly, you make sure that it's a state that's friendly. Honestly, Illinois has, as much as I can criticize Illinois on a lot of things, they're not all that bad as far as their state as being a corporation incorporated in Illinois is concerned. Now, understand, though, that that corporation is a legal entity. It is a person under the law. There was a Supreme Court decision a few years back that where the Supreme Court of the United States said, well, corporations have First Amendment rights to free speech because they are persons under the law. See, that was taking it way too far. That's just sheer stupid. We say person under the law to recognize that it is responsible for its own bills, is responsible for its own life. But it ain't no person as far as a human being citizen goes, but that was what the majority of the Supreme Court, and we all just, a lot of people, just Citizens United, we just kind of, God, that's taking it too far. Here's why. I'm going to share a secret with you, okay? You're going to die someday. It's going to hurt like hell, probably. No, not okay. No, you don't understand, noob. I'm getting old. I've seen, you know, you're walking by this pane glass window and you see this black figure behind you with a hook, a scythe. You turn around and he just acts like he doesn't know what you're talking. You will die. You keep saying, okay, you're in denial. No, you're not. You're thinking, he's wrong about that. I'll get some of that electronic stuff. I'll upload my soul to the web. No. You see, here's the thing, is corporations don't die. They are not mortal. They can be killed, but they do not of their nature die. Humans of their nature die. That's the difference with a corporation. Theoretically, it lives forever. You're going to see us put that into practice. When we price stock and things like that, We're pricing them on infinite timelines and then telescoping those back to the present value. You'll see it. That's how we do it. Because we know that a corporation cannot die. Again, it can be killed by its own stupidity or by sovereign decree, but of its nature, it is immortal. And that is a kind of scary thing when you think about it. Immortality means that it is not a person in the sense of what our founding fathers probably would have thought a person is. Yeah, we use the term person for things that aren't humans. As a matter of fact, a marriage, if you get married to someone, the marriage is a person under the law because it is responsible under the law for certain legal behaviors. Yeah. So it's recognized under the law. A corporation is a person under the law. A corporation is a person under the law. There are other things that can be persons under the law, too. You'll see in contracts, person is used in a broad sense in legal terms. So do understand this, that the power of a corporation is that it cannot die. The shareholders are not responsible for the debts of the corporation. The shareholders are not responsible for the debts of the corporation. They cannot be, if the company can't pay its bills, the debt holders can take everything in that corporation. But unless those debt holders can put some very serious evidence in front of the judge, the bankruptcy judge will not pierce the corporate veil. In other words, as long as the shareholders don't make the corporation their little toy, the debt holders can go no further than the doors of the corporation itself to claim what's due them. That's powerful. That's why I have a corporation. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't buy insurance to protect my corporation, because you see, the corporation can't protect itself. It's not a living thing. So the people who are the directors and the officers of a corporation have a fiduciary duty. They are responsible for protecting that child that will never grow up. Be sure you understand that. That means that when we, like, for example, a parent is the agent of a child, fiduciary duty, highest duty implied by law. The same is true for the officers and directors of a corporation. A corporation is not a living thing. It can't protect itself. So the officers and directors have a fiduciary duty to protect it. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.